Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
There are absolutely going to be some people who are listening, and when they hear we're going to be talking about David Johnson testifying, are going to be saying, okay, enough. We get what's going on. We get it. Except today was fascinating. Today he was testifying at a Commons committee about his report, and boy, there was some stuff there that honestly, you kind of, I did anyway, shake your head and say, I don't really get what's going on. Duff Conacher is the guy behind Democracy Watch, joins us now. Duff, how are you today?
Well, how are you?
I am well, but I'm confused, honestly. And I'll tell you why I'm confused is because it seems from what I watched, I didn't see every minute of it, but I watched a bunch of it, that David Johnson is acknowledging in his testimony that much of his report was done without some information available. He said, we wrote what we did. We concluded what we did with the information we had available, but now acknowledges that there's other information that wasn't available around Aaron O'Toole and others, but yet still says, no, this is good enough though. We still don't need to have any further hearings on this. I don't quite understand how you can say we don't know everything or our opinion changed, but the result is the same.
I agree. It's just one of many puzzles in this situation. And he was really exposed by a few pointed questions from mostly NDP and conservative MPs saying, look, here's this report that is public. It's been disclosed to the committee, says that there was a social media account run by the Communist Party of China and had 26 million followers and was publishing propaganda to interfere and influence Canadian politics. And yet you concluded there was no state government identified to have been behind any of this interference. And how can you say that? And he just kept on saying, well, the information we had at the time. And to close it off when there's so much information that he clearly didn't look at or consider fully, and then add to that the fact that he's a friend of Trudeau, according to both Trudeau and Johnston, they're friends, and never should have been doing the job in the first place and has an appearance of bias for that reason. It just points that we need an independent inquiry where the inquiry commissioner is selected by all the party leaders, not just by the ruling party, prime minister and cabinet. And or you're going to continue having committee hearings that with the committee controlled by opposition parties. And they're not going to stop holding these hearings because there's no reason to stop.
Let me jump in for 1 second. Just say, okay, just for the sake of today's discussion, and although you're right about the appearances of not bias necessarily, but that there's too many ties, all those kinds of things, and those discussions can go on. Let's leave those aside for a second. I just, today to me, what really struck me again is, let's say that you were going to work on a house, on a foundation, and you made a plan, and then you came back later when you tore out the drywall and found out that there was something different from what you had expected. You don't plunge ahead with the same plans. You then, because you've got new information, you change your plans to deal with what you've now discovered. I get that maybe he didn't have all this information. I completely understand that. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt to say he was not provided with all the information we now know. What I don't get is how you hold on to your conclusion that even so, we still have the same conclusion. That's the part that makes no sense to me.
I agree. And to use your analogy, if you're buying a house and you didn't have a home inspection, then you don't conclude that it's 100% great house in perfect condition until you look behind the walls.
Right.
And
right.
And there's all sorts of walls that he has not looked behind. He admitted that today. And so we need an inquiry to look behind those walls.
So why, I mean, is it as simple? Let's go back to what you mentioned a moment ago then. Is it really, I don't want to believe that David Johnson is just a political hack. I don't. I think he's a man who up until now has carried a great position of integrity within this country. I don't want to believe that he is just playing a political game here. Is there something else going on, or is that what's happening?
I really don't know. No one can do a Vulcan mind meld except Spock.
True.
Spock, a fictional character. Yeah. And because of that, conflict of interest rules say when you have an appearance of a conflict, you step aside and you do not take part in decisions or judgments of a friend, of your family member, of yourself, of anyone you have a connection with that would make it improper and appear to smell. And he shouldn't be doing the job for that reason. I don't know why he's done what he's done and tried to say we're going to say this is a great house. There's no foreign interference here. I'm not going to look in the attic or behind the walls, but I'm just going to say we have to stop looking into this and get on with changing the laws. I don't know why he did that. I can't do a Vulcan mind meld with him. But I do know that he has a relationship enough with Trudeau. He said it's a long time relationship himself. Trudeau said they're friends. You can't be judging friends. And that's what he did in his first report. And that means it's an invalid report. Just like if he was a judge and was judging Trudeau in court, people would say that's an invalid ruling and the Court of Appeal would overturn it for appearance of bias. So that's where we're at. And we need that fully independent inquiry. If we don't get it, the Liberals don't do it, then a committee that's controlled by opposition party members is going to continue holding hearings. And it's not the best forum because opposition party members control it. And so they're biased. So that's why we need a person that's approved by all the parties who will then be viewed as impartial because all the parties would have approved of the person and have them look into it. And I don't know, understand why the Liberals are allowing this to fester. All it's doing is smelling more and more.
And, you know, for those who didn't watch today and think, oh, this is just Pierre Poilievre, this is just the Conservatives who are hammering on this to score political points, it should probably be pointed out that the NDP and Jagmeet Singh, also on the left, were also hammering away at him. I mean, it's everybody except for the Liberals.
Yeah, no, the Bloc, the NDP, and the Conservatives all voted asking David Johnston to resign from his position because of the appearance of bias. It's united, and as well as pretty much every newspaper editorial board across the country, including the Toronto Star, which is generally viewed as favoring the Liberals, saying that this smells too much. There's too much appearance of bias, and none of them have said this, but no one can do a Vulcan mind meld. I'm sorry, mm-hmm. David Johnston, you can say you act with integrity and your relationship has not tainted your conclusions, but we can't know that because no one can go inside your head. And maybe you're telling the truth, but maybe not. And that doubt means that we need to have that doubt removed by having an independent inquiry with someone chosen by all the parties. Just like every watchdog who watches over politics has to be chosen by all the parties. We have to end this process of allowing inquiry commissioners, the ethics watchdog, lobbying watchdog, the information commissioner, the auditor general, the head of Elections Canada, all of them currently chosen by the ruling party, even though they make rulings on all the parties. And that bias has to stop. And we need independent people in all of these watchdog positions. Otherwise, we don't have a democracy.
Let me just finish with this, and we only have a few seconds left, but I don't know that we were ever going to depoliticize this issue at all. It was never going to not be a political thing, but has it become more politicized by the fact that the person who is supposed to be independent appears to not really want to get too far into this or appears to have drawn conclusions that are incomplete? I mean, based on what we're hearing today, has it become more politicized than it was ever going to be?
Yes. And it's not just him. The deputy ministers who serve on the panel that is supposed to watch for this stuff all serve at the pleasure of Trudeau and were selected by him. Morris Rosenberg, who looked at that panel and how it worked and was appointed by Trudeau to do that, was on with the Trudeau Foundation. The lawyer that David Johnston hired donated only to the Liberal Party from 2006 mm-hmm. to 2022. It's a layer cake of conflicts of interest. And Canadians quite justifiably do not trust that fully independent, impartial investigations and findings are being done in this situation. And that's why we need a fully independent inquiry with the inquiry commissioner or commissioners approved by all the parties. It's the only solution. And I don't know why Trudeau is allowing the smell to just grow.
It really does seem odd that today it was acknowledged basically by David Johnston that he did not have all the information. He said that in not so many words, 25, 30 times.
Yes.
And yet we are now still, he is still saying, but even though I didn't have all the information, I'm still pretty good with my conclusion. We got to run, Duff. I wish we could keep going. That's a weird one. It's a weird position to try and parse that. But anyway, Duff Conacher with Democracy Watch. Always love having you on. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you. Take care.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
So much anger, and I think justifiably so. I would not, well, on Friday when this story broke, I was expressing the same feeling. So much anger about this decision by our corrections system to move Paul Bernardo to a medium security prison for all kinds of reasons. For all kinds of reasons. First and foremost, just a general loathing of the man. And you heard that even from politicians, from Doug Ford and from others. But also, and this is where I think people in this country get a little nervous. We saw Carla Homolka. Now, her deal allowed her less of a prison term, but we saw her out in a minimum security and then just out on the streets. A number of people today saying, wait a second, if you're reducing someone's situation from maximum security to medium security, I don't know that we ever expect that Paul Bernardo is going to be on the street, but this feels like it's moving him towards day parole or something. Why would you move a person like this if there wasn't some direction that it was being pushed? Let me bring in Jeff Manishin. He is a local defense lawyer, former Crown attorney. He is as familiar with how this whole thing works as anyone. Jeff, how are you today?
Just great, Scott. How are you?
I am terrific, although like a lot of people, I'm a little ticked, or more than a little ticked about this, mainly because it seems that we, for whatever reason, don't want to take a hard line with even the worst of our worst of our worst criminals and seem to want to find a way to make things better for them, even a little bit better. And I think a lot of people are saying, no, no, why are we trying to make things even a little bit better for someone like Paul Bernardo?
Let me offer the disclaimer, first of all, that I won't speak to the conditions of the prison that Bernardo has been in, as opposed to the prison that he's going to.
Okay.
But let's look at it from another standpoint. If we say maximum security is meant for the potentially the most dangerous offenders from the standpoint of flight risk, from the standpoint of risk of harm to others, including others in the institution, then you say, okay, we can understand what maximum security is for. And we aren't necessarily saying, and it'll be the most punitive with the harshest conditions and the least resources and the least programming and all, because that's what we mean by maximum security equals most punitive.
Right.
No, that's not. We don't equate those two. The phrase maximum security means that we have to exercise the greatest measure of scrutiny or control over their activity because of the potential, whether it's a matter of escape risk or harm to others. Okay. Next, if we say, okay, but medium security, for example, may well be a facility that is certainly as secure in terms of escape, but you may have an inmate who, for a variety of reasons, doesn't need quite as close scrutiny because you're satisfied that individual might not represent as much of a flight risk or doesn't represent as much of a risk to other offenders, you know, matters such as that. You might say, within an institution, we could reclassify and say this individual can be classified to a medium security. And again, medium security doesn't mean less punitive, okay? It means there can be a different measure of, I'll characterize it as security. That's the word that's used. So now, we don't know the reasoning behind the decision by Corrections Canada to classify him such that he could go into a medium security institution in Quebec. There could be a host of different reasons.
And let's jump in there, Jeff. Let me jump in, because that's one of the things, I think, too, that is making a lot of people really upset about this, that the corrections system is, first of all, they didn't tell anyone or very few people. It was almost a secret. And then they say, well, we can't talk about it because of personnel privacy issues. And I think a lot of people, and I know a lot of people, are saying, how in the world does Paul Bernardo get to fall under personnel and privacy issues? We should know everything that's happening with this person. Why does he have privacy?
And I'll answer back, let's characterize it rhetorically. If there's the concept of a privacy interest for somebody in an institution, we don't have two categories of privacy, and there is that. that the fact that you're in a prison doesn't mean that the world gets to know what programs you're taking or what range you're on. So if we said we're going to have two categories, we're going to have all the inmates that are in there except for the ones whose cases got a lot of news coverage. For them, we get to know. They don't have the same privacy rights as the other people. Well, the legislative scheme doesn't work that way. It allows, I think, a narrow component of disclosure of some information about an inmate when there's a specific public interest in it. So, for example, if an inmate was being released to a particular community in a halfway house, you'll see that. And I would say as well, you may have cases in which somebody might be getting day parole. Okay, could be potentially relevant. But shy of that, Scott, we don't have a two-tier categorization of what the public gets to know. Okay, and I'll give you a variation on it. There are certainly lots of people who are serving life sentences for murder in the penitentiary now. Do we get to know every time they have they're shifted in a classification level from maximum to medium? Do we get to have, we're going to have a standing report all the time for all the individuals serving life sentences?
Should we?
Is that how it's going to be done?
No, but I mean, should there be a website that says here's where this person is and it's marked if they're moving? I mean, I look at this almost like, and I think a lot of people do too, and I don't know, I mean, I know this is not how our system works right now because our system is all about rehabilitation and trying to get someone back into society. Now, I don't think that that's really what they're doing with Paul Bernardo, I hope. But I do think there's a lot of people. We have judges are permitted to declare someone a dangerous offender, which is a different category in prison and with their penalty. I'd love, and I think a lot of people would, to say, you know what, you're one of those people who just gets to stay in your room for 23 hours, in your cell for 23 hours. You don't get privileges. What you did is so egregious, is so against society's mores and values and sensibilities that don't even come to us and ask for preferential treatment or a hand down to medium security. You are spending the rest of your life 23 hours a day in a cell. Go away. I think we'd love to see that.
Oh, I'm sure. You know, you could say, why don't you do more than that? Just keep him in solitary confinement without any lights. I mean, what the heck? Why should he have any lights?
Okay.
And he shouldn't have a TV, and he shouldn't have a computer, and he shouldn't get to see other people. I mean, we can take it to extremes. But, you know, of course, Scott, the issue regarding segregation and individuals in those isolation cells has come under a lot of scrutiny. We aren't into the world of an entirely wholly punitive, revenge-based sentencing regime. That's number one. But number two is judges have the authority to be able to impose a sentence of how long the person will be in jail. And then it's left to Corrections Canada to determine what resources are going to be available, what facilities, what kind of programs, and what happens to the individual. That's not the stage of further, I'll characterize it as, punitive restrictions. It's meant to, it's obviously significantly restrictive. But the question is, how much more punishment do you want to have within it? I can't ever see a regime such as you suggested being upheld constitutionally. I think people would find it cruel and unusual punishment.
Do you, though? Okay. And I know that that's not what we do here. I know that under a circumstance like this, or like Robert Picton, or like, what's his name, who was out west, who...
I forget the guy's last name. Yeah. He's certainly a multiple murderer,
right?
Involving a number of children.
But I'll think of it in just a second. Yeah, I'll think of it in a second. But should though the person, so someone at Corrections Canada gave the okay. Someone had to give the okay that Bernardo was going to move, regardless of all the other stuff. Should that person have been more aware? They had to know this was going to blow up. They had to know. And what this does, I think, is it draws attention and scrutiny and cynicism and criticism of the entire system. Paul Bernardo, I don't know that anyone is going to say he is worth the hassle of what they're going to have to deal with. Should that person not have just been wiser and said, look, we can move some other people, as you describe, who don't have the attention. Paul Bernardo is a lightning rod. All this is going to do is put all kinds of spotlights on our system that we don't need.
I guess I'd answer it this way. How should what's the individual's reasoning for the transfers to begin with that? What's the evidence base for it? What's the policy basis for it? Why now? Why there? I mean, we don't know that reasoning. We should say this, though.
Should we?
Anybody making that call better have a host of really good defensible reasons up, down, and sideways, because you know and I know it's going to be the subject of significant scrutiny.
Okay, now, so if we're not going to keep a track, as we described before, where every person is, we're going to know, should these decisions be public? Should a decision for why Bernardo was moved be made public? Because right now they're saying we don't do that.
Well, I'm not going to suggest that any time an inmate gets moved to a different classification, it automatically is going to be publicized, okay? In this case, because of the public attention, I bet that we will hear more of the reasoning. Okay, alternative, we may well. I'm going to give you an alternative, though, Scott.
Okay.
Once we have the public safety minister, Mendocino, saying, I'm just shocked at this, and although I can't tell him what to do because, of course, it's his authority, I certainly want to convey to him how shocked I am. It wouldn't surprise me at all if we see suddenly the thing gets reconsidered and he gets shifted back to Miller.
Yep, yep.
And we'll never know the reason.
Yep.
That could very well play out that way. And I'll go one further. You know, it would have been interesting, you know, I'm going to say from a legal standpoint, to know what those reasons were and try and evaluate, did they have some substance to them? If we accept for the moment that the medium security institution he's going to in Quebec is no less punitive or restrictive than Millhaven, let's assume that for the moment. And let's assume, for example, what if, hypothetically, they're concerned about security risk for his safety, okay, or there's programming or other things that could be done at the other institution that can't be done for him where he is. Or they say, gee, he is not as severe a risk as he was 10 years ago or 5 years ago of escaping or harming anybody else. We can now classify him medium, okay? And the federal penitentiary in Quebec is every bit as punitive. Would people say, well, that's no good still? Remember, if I'm predicating it on, it's every bit as punitive and restrictive. It's medium because we're less concerned about him harming others or escaping.
It's a fascinating topic. I know we'll be talking about this much more. We're out of time now, but Jeff Manishin, always love having you on for these discussions. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Scott. It's a pleasure for me, too. We always seem to find challenging issues we go back and forth on, and it's a vigorous intellectual workout.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Let me bring in Bubba O'Neill, who just finished doing sports. I had it on the TV here. Couldn't hear the sound, but lots of coverage today of this. It's really a huge business move in the world of golf, Bubba, but it's also, boy, is it a controversial one.
You know, I thought it was well described by our anchor, Taz Boga, today, that called it a sort of a business story. You know, and it is. It's a business story that involves sports. And, you know, I think about it. I'll be honest with you, Scott. I mean, I don't know. I've been doing regional, national, and local sports for, I don't know, 30 years, I guess, in my life. 35, or I don't know about that. 30 years, at least. I don't know if I've ever woke up in the morning and felt like I've been hit over an anvil, like in the head with an anvil, like I was this morning. Like, I I know I'm not the only one. PGA Tour players, PGA Tour fans, analysts, Live Golf analysts, Greg Norman, the CEO of Live, no one knew this was happening.
No.
This was held to such a selected few that got this deal done, or at least, there's still deals to be worked on, but this agreement will say that going forward, nobody saw this coming.
All right, Bubba, let me jump in for a sec, because I just want to explain, if there's five people who don't know what we're talking about, essentially 2.5-3 years ago, Greg Norman, with the Saudi government, the backing of Saudi money, started this spin-off Live Golf Tour and paid literally hundreds of millions of dollars to PGA Tour players to lure them to come and play here. The PGA Tour at the time said, if you go, told its players, if you go, you're not coming back. You're not welcome back here. And so a bunch of guys went and took big paydays, and a whole bunch of other guys said, no, I'm not going because I want to stay. I believe in the PGA Tour. I don't want to be a sellout. And they now, if you read stories that are starting to trickle out after this 4 o'clock meeting today and things on social media, there's a bunch of those guys, Bubba, who decided, I'm not going because I'm not going to take that big payday because I'm loyal to this tour and I believe in the legacy of my career and all the rest. They are, by the sounds of it, enraged by this. Some of these people have lost hundreds of millions of dollars.
Let's be honest here, okay? I'm going to be as fair as I can here, and I'll localize it for our listeners here. A guy like Adam Hadwin, Dundas native Mackenzie Hughes, even Whistle Ontario's Ford Connors, I don't know if they'll ever be number one in the world. And I would say that the chances are they will never be number one in the world. They may always bounce around the top 20 and there was a financial opportunity, and I'll use Dundas Native Defenses Union as an example, because he was very vocal in against the Live Golf series, believing that the best golf was played on the PGA Tour. And that may, argument may continue for, you know, forever. You never know what was better or not. But a financial gain was available to golfers like that, good golfers that have won golf tournaments, to make that switch. We all know about the Phil, the $200 million that Phil Mickelson.
Bubba, let me jump in for a sec. We're going to get Ben to call you right back because we got a terrible phone connection. Okay, we're not hearing you real well, so we're going to call you right back and reset this connection just so we can hear what you're saying, because it is, again, what he's talking about, what Bubba's saying, is a lot of these guys. So Phil Mickelson, for example, I think got $200 million to jump to the LIV Golf Tour, and others. Tiger Woods was offered, then reportedly, Tiger Woods was offered $800 to $900 million and turned it down because of the belief that they were gone. If you left, you left. And Tiger Woods, you know, he's made a lot of money. Tiger Woods, his legacy mattered to him. And so, well, I mean, and even he's got some skeletons in the closet. We all know that story. Let me try again now. Bob, are you back now?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Way better, way better. Okay.
Okay. I was just talking about the financial gain that golfers like a Mackenzie Hughes, you know, for his young family, could have benefited from going to that LIV Golf Tour, and the many that did. And as much as $250 million after winning the Masters this year, John Rahm, and apparently thinking about it, and he's been very critical of the PGA Tour and the PGA Tour of America for a countryman like his own, Sergio Garcia, not being able to be at the Ryder Cup this year. This is a complete mess. And it is, in the end, it will break down. And I don't know how history will treat this, Scott. But in the end, it's like the LIV Golf League had it right all along, and the PGA Tour totally had it wrong. They look like hypocrites.
Well, they can. I mean, look, or the PGA Tour... if you want to, you say, look, you can go, you can leave, you can take your money, and we are going to stand our ground, and those guys who are here are going to be considered the great golfers. You can have money or you can have legacy, and the guys who stay here have chosen legacy. But when you then back down, so now you're sharing a locker room with guys who left, who decided they were willing to give up what you're playing for, because they wanted the payday, but now they get to come back with that giant wad of cash, and they get to compete for what you're playing for. Someone like Rory McIlroy, who has stuck his neck out to fight for the PGA Tour, who could have also made tons of money, he's got to be enraged by this at the leadership, that he basically risked his relationship with players, risked his career, and now they've basically said, oh, everybody come back. And Rory, by the way, all that money you could have made, sorry, too bad. It went to other guys. I don't know how the leadership of the PGA Tour can possibly survive this.
Jay Monahan is going to get destroyed. And I would love to have been just a little speaker or a fly on the wall for that meeting between the PGA Tour players that are here in Toronto that he spoke to update them on the situation. I think it was 4 o'clock this afternoon when that meeting went on. I'm sure there was yelling, screaming, angry. Like you said it right there. Like, friendships were broken up over this. There was an allegiance that was broken up. There were sides being taken. Nationalistic flags were being flied, you know, in terms of sense of America over Saudi Arabia. Like, this, it was a big, big deal. And to see that at the end of the day, think about this, Scott. Last year, we already saw, I mean, again, no one really expected what we heard today to happen, this merger to happen. But in 1 year, the PGA Tour, I don't know if they started to notice some things. Purses were increased because they could see the money that the LIV Golf guys were leaving for. This year was the start of a couple of no-cut tournaments, right? Which is the exact model of the LIV Golf series. This team golf aspect, which appears to me from what things that Monahan said today, it looks like next year going forward there will be a team golf aspect of the PGA Tour, whatever it's called.
different than what Eagle has today. But many of the things we saw Live Golf doing are going to be part of the PGA.
Yes. Yes, but again, I come back to the point of this one. We in our life, we're told all the time, you make choices and those choices have consequences and, you know, you can't turn left and right at the same time. So, you know what, these people, the guys who left, chose money and gave up the chance to play on the PGA Tour. The guys who stayed made a choice. But where it's going to be, as I say, so enraging, I think, to the guys who stayed is that you made a choice that had a consequence, and now the guy in charge of the PGA Tour basically is saying, oh, just kidding. So they get all the benefit, and the guys who fought for the leadership of the PGA Tour, the very guy who's now hung them out to dry, they have lost out. They're getting whacked double.
Well, this is why this entire merger and the way it's been presented to us at least over less than 24 hours is so... It's so hypocritical. It's so insane. Because, I mean, here's a quick example. And people know this man very well. A good friend of yours, a colleague of yours for very, very many years, Gary McKay.
Yep.
Hall of Fame golf writer. Lucky to have him here in Hamilton. I consider him a friend. But we do not agree on the Live Golf versus PGA Golf discussion. And we, as close as 2 weeks ago on social media, had a discussion or words exchange about the Ryder Cup players, like a Brooks Koepka, not being able to play for America. And I said this is hypocritical, this is ridiculous. Golf is better to have a guy like Brooks Koepka just win the PGA Tour championship and possibly coming so close to winning the Masters. It hurts that event. And he said exactly what you said, is that those guys made a choice, and with choices, there are consequences. Who would have ever thought 2 weeks after our discussion that the consequences actually flipped?
Yeah, that the people who stood on principle have kind of been left here looking like they're the idiots. And here's the other part that becomes so complicated with this now. Many of those who stayed and didn't go to the Live Tour and take the big money, many of them pointed to the fact that this was money that was coming from questionable origins from a regime.
Don't even go there.
Okay. Nonetheless, a regime that has human rights problems, and some people called it blood money. And they said, I do not want to play in a tour where the blood money is driving it. This arrangement gives the head of the Saudi something or other a main seat at the table, and some of their money is now going to be contributing to the PGA Tour. So you don't even have a choice now if you are one of those players who stood up and said, I don't want to support this. They've drawn this Saudi money into the PGA Tour, so your only choice now, if you want to really stand on principle, is not to play on the PGA Tour, which is going to infuriate some of these people even more, that they're kind of forced now, due to no fault of their own, to look like hypocrites, because once upon a time they said, I won't play for Saudi oil or Saudi blood money, and now they're going to, even though they haven't moved. It's not them who've moved. It's the tour leadership that's moved.
That's what's so insane about this. And it's not even like it's a little bit of money, right? This is what's lured the PGA Tour, because the Saudi money gives them, the PGA Tour, infinite amounts of power. And this is why they continue to say, look, I will say this. Is golf next year and going forward probably going to be in a better space? I absolutely do. Because I think you have ideas, money influences. I think golf will be in a better place 10 years from now than it is right now. That's what I truly believe. Now, I've been criticized on social media, email. As you well know, CHCH is a broadcast partner with Live Golf. And I've watched that audience slowly grow. Okay? And maybe the worst thing that ever happened to the PGA Tour was seeing the likes of the fact that the major championships are not controlled by the PGA Tour. In this case, we just saw the PGA Championship was controlled by the PGA of America, and which allowed, and the Masters actually, the people around, which allowed golfers, if they could qualify, if they had the, you know, existing qualifications, that they could qualify,
tournament that they were allowed to. And what did we see? In the Masters and in the PGA Championship, three of the top five golfers in those tournaments were all live golfers. So what did that do? To me, that made the PGA Tour look. And yeah. I believe that was just one more reason for their knees to buckle.
We got to run. We're just having some technical problems today. But, Bob, I really appreciate you jumping in. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thanks for having me, bud.
It's going to be fascinating to see. Sorry about the technical stuff. Don't know what was going on today. Really interesting to see. The Canadian Open is on this week. It's the tournament itself starts Thursday, practice round or pro-am or something tomorrow. Practice rounds were today. All this is happening with the players here. Going to be really fascinating to see if there is any visible showdown between the players who are on live, if there's any who are here. I don't know if there's any at the Canadian Open. I don't think there are. But even going forward into the next weeks, now that presumably some of these guys are going to be able to come back and rejoin the PGA Tour and play on the tour, I don't believe that it's possible that the leadership is going to survive this, because the players just seem so enraged. And you can understand why. I think anybody can understand why. This is a fascinating soap opera of a story. It's not even a golf story. I mean, it is, but it's not really. It's a soap opera, and it's Shakespearean almost in how this is done. And then the people who had stood for something, who had stood on principle, end up being the ones who kind of get stabbed in the back. It's a striking story. Because if all of these players had, Bubba mentioned Mackenzie Hughes. I haven't asked Mackenzie. I talk to him every once in a while. He's a local guy. He's always good to pick up his phone. I'll tell you one thing about Mackenzie Hughes, totally off topic with what we're talking about. There are athletes from any city that start small, which Mackenzie did, and go on to amazing things. And some of them forget where they started from. No names being mentioned right now, but some of them forget where they started from, and others never do. Mackenzie Hughes has never forgotten. I do not reach out a lot because he's got lots of things going on, but I can tell you that every time I text Mackenzie Hughes, because I wrote about him back when he was like 16 years old, every time I reach out to Mackenzie Hughes, he gets back without fail. Which I always am impressed by, not because it's me, but because I am representative in some ways of home to him when he's on the tour. Anyway, back to her. I haven't talked to him about this particular thing, but I bet you that he could have got a contract with LIV and probably got $15 or $20 million minimum to go there and join the tour. Probably more. Didn't do it. And now other guys are coming back who got lots of money, and they get all the same benefits that he fought for to be here and standing his ground. It's almost Shakespearean. It's a fascinating story.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.